Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we will have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is an all-star guest from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. You've heard him on numerous shows, though, interestingly, we just discovered we have not recorded together before, so I am especially excited for today, and I feel really honored to have him on this episode. Please welcome Keith G. Baker. Keith, how you doing?
Hey, Sean. How's it going, man? I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me in. Yeah, I couldn't believe that we hadn't podcasted together before either, but I listen to you all the time, so it's like I already know you, so just if I get too familiar, just tell me to keep going.
No, it is. It's the funny nature of our little comic book podcasting community, right? Like, we've all heard each other on shows. We followed each other on social media. You know, we've all interacted about this thing that we love. And then there are those moments where you're like, oh, we've never actually met. Like, this is great. So, no, I love it. I count myself very fortunate, this is the common trend. I've never had a bad experience with anybody in our little community. Every person I've met in person, every person I've met with, you know, via recording, you know, or interacted with on social media has been nothing but delightful. So I just think it speaks to the nature of people who collect comics. I think most of us are just awesome people.
Oh yeah, I found that to be the case too. I mean, no matter where people come from or what their background is, if you find out that they love comics and you love comics, that there's some sort of special bond there. That just happens. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think there's something about growing up reading the adventures of people, of characters who are inherently trying to do good. It builds a nice moral backbone. You know, it makes all of us maybe just extra nice and understanding. So before we jump in, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows. So we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, Keith, I'm going to ask you the same question I ask everybody as we open the episode. What's your history with Wonder Woman? How'd you first discover the character?
Well, I mean, like most people my age, which is getting pretty ancient, it of course started off with Super Friends. She was the woman on the team. She was like, you know, in my young head, she was the analog to Superman. She was just the female version. You know? She was like Superwoman, you know, or whatever. So, you know, Super Friends, of course. I started reading real early. So I was like reading through comic books when I was like four. So JLA, she was the female member of the JLA, you know, eventually Black Canary joined too. But one person that had the most influence on me was Linda Carter. And yeah, I didn't understand it at the time when I was watching it in syndication. But yes, Linda Carter stuck with me and still sticks with me to this day. But really, I never really got into Wonder Woman until this series from George Perez. And it's really because of George Perez. You know, because you were seeing him everywhere. JLA, you saw him doing some flashes, you know, all this other stuff that I was reading. And all of a sudden, they rebooted everything, and George was going to be doing it. I had no idea coming into it what it was going to be. Picked up the first couple issues, and I think that was around the time, like junior year in high school, when I realized that it's very based in Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. Well, at the time, and you're a teacher, right?
Yeah.
So at the time, I was in a program. I don't think they do it anymore, but it was called the Padea program.
They do, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I trained with them at one point.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, they were experimenting on us kids in the late 80s. And I was one of the experimental kids. I did it, I think, junior and senior year or maybe sophomore year also. But anyway, basically the Padea program, for nobody who knows, was they kind of come – they were supposed to teach a different way, more of a Socratic seminar, everybody mm-hmm. getting in a circle and, you know, you talking with your peers about stuff. And it started off with the social studies and English classes were separate, but then those two classes would get together And then normally like whatever you were reading in English was written in the English class was written around the same time as what you're studying in social studies. They, you know, so the teachers would go back and forth who would control the seminars and whatnot. But, you know, around that time we were reading, you know, the Theban plays and stuff like that. Of course, we were focused on Antigone because that's who everybody focused on was Antigone. All about youth rebellion or whatever. So, you know, but the main thing that I remember about the about being in this program was we read a lot of like Greek myths to start off, just kind of as a lead up to our discussions. And I had been interested in Greek mythology since like elementary school. It was always the books that I checked out. There was that one mythology book. I forget what it was.
There's Bullfinches. There's Edith Hamilton's.
Edith Hamilton. That was I knew it was written by a woman, but I checked that out like every week almost, it seemed like, when I was in elementary school, just reading over and over, you know, these myths. And I rediscovered it in high school. And around that same time, George Perez drops in our lap.
Nice.
Wonder Woman with the Greek mythology. And the way that he's writing it was, you know, true to the way these gods acted in those things that I'd already read. I thought it was pretty cool. Plus, George Perez's art. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I was there.
I cannot tell you how happy this makes me. The Paideia program, it does still exist, and it's funny, not so much as a huge program itself, but in particular as a training center for Socratic seminar and Socratic method. And so I actually came up in that method as a teacher in my first teaching job. I taught at a school that used a constructivist philosophy where students construct their own learning. It's a very, at the time, and this is 27 years ago, it wasn't, you know, teaching was very much the sage on the stage. And, you know, and in my mind, it's always, I always tell my students this, and I tell my daughter this, the difference between a teacher and a professor is in the title. Teachers are there to teach. They're there to assume you're going to encounter some struggles and to help guide you through them as you construct your learning. A professor professes what they know. They're two very different jobs, actually. And teaching, when I first got into the career, was a lot of professing. And so I was very fortunate that my first teaching job was at this constructivist school that paid for me to get trained in Socratic seminars and Socratic methodology. And then I was an English teacher, and I taught their 10th grade curriculum was a classical curriculum. So very similar to what you just described. We've started with Greek mythology. We started with Hamilton's mythology. And then we would read Oedipus read the Iliad, Oedipus, Antigone. We'd go all the way through like Dante's Inferno, Hamlet, Paradise Lost. And I loved those works. And it hit me in my heart because I loved Greek mythology as well. And so it's so funny because I didn't realize until doing this show and going back and doing a comprehensive, thoughtful reread of this series, just how beautifully steeped in mythology it is and just how much research, you know, George, Len, and Greg Potter all did, Karen Berger, because they took those myths and they're like, oh, Zeus? Yeah, he's a disgusting serial rapist. Let's make him really perverse. Oh, you know, Heracles, you know, driven mad by Hera, put through some things that weren't his fault, but still hot-headed moron. Let's follow that. And I love the fact that this comic is like a beautiful companion to, you know, Hamilton's mythology. So I can't tell you how happy it makes me that you're bringing these things up because they are literally my favorite, you know, works I ever taught.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the great thing about the Greek gods is that all of them are fallible.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, from Hera to Artemis, every one of them has some sort of story where, you know, they made human-like choices that had great repercussions and stuff like that. But, you know, at 53 years old, looking back at the 16, 17-year-old me who went in these Socratic seminars, I thought at that time the coolest thing was all of us sitting in a circle, and I got to see everybody in the class, including the ladies and
whatnot. Uh-huh.
So that was a lot cooler than sitting in rows. You know, we actually interacted with our peers rather than just listening to lectures. So looking back on it, I, as an older man now, I'm glad I had that base to go off of, you know, back then, and I wish they would do it more.
it does make a huge difference. And just as a teacher, I can tell you, it brings classes closer together. Because you're right, if you're just in traditional rows, you could be a kid in a class. I remember this from high school. My high school had 3,500 people in it. My graduating class had almost 900 or more folks in it. And I, you know, there were classes I was in where I would look around and I'd be like, I've literally never seen that person before. And I've been in this classroom with them for, you know, 7 months. So no, it is. It's a fun way to teach too, honestly. It's in a weird way, it takes some of the pressure off you. But in another way, you have to know the content even better because you don't know what they're going to bring. So you have to be able to make any of the jumps they're making with them, which is also just super fun. So that's awesome, man. That just makes my day.
Yeah. Critical thinking is what
yeah.
You know, nobody seems to have anymore.
But. I was going to say, which we are in a short supply today. So jumping to the comic itself, we are looking at Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 17, which is titled Traces. It was released in June of 88. It has a script and layouts by George Perez. I'll get to that in a second. Finished art by legendary Dick Giordano. Letters by John Costanza, colored by Carl Gafford, and edited by Karen Berger. So it's worth noting, this is actually the first issue where George is fully tackling the writing duties. Greg Potter had co-plotted and done the scripting for the first few issues. Len Wein comes in, co-plots, and does the scripting for the next, 10 or something issues. George at one point takes over plotting, and Len is just scripting. So this is a natural evolution. But we have, George doing the writing duties full time. And then we've got our third inker in a row. We had pretty consistent inking by Bruce Patterson through most of the series, and even finishes by Patterson, who did a great job. Last issue, we had Bob Hall, who's a legendary inker from the Bronze Age. And then, you don't think of, if you say to me comic book inkers, two names come to mind as like the two big pillars. It's Terry Austin and Dick Giordano. So, you don't get much better than, oh, hey, by the way, Dick Giordano's filling in on this issue. And actually, not a secret question. This is not something I had prepared. I just wonder, inking is such a specific thing to comics, and in particular to comics of like Bronze Age and a little bit after. Like, we don't actually really see inkers, colorists almost take care of that job in modern day comics. Do you have specific inkers that you think are the best or that you really love?
I'm not the art guy, so I wouldn't know an inker from a letter. I couldn't pick them out of a lineup normally. Uh-huh. But I do know that whenever I see Dick Giordano's name, or Al Milgrom, I like him just because he would with his inks, back when he was doing Firestorm and other stuff, he was kind of a heavier inker. But he seemed to bring out the best of the pencils that he was doing. But yeah, when it comes to art, I'm not really the guy. I was always more of a plot dialogue kind of guy, but.
Oh, me too. It's only as I collected, and Perez, for example, I think Romeo Tangal, who inked his early Titans work, is the best inker for George. I think he brings out the sort of Perezian emoting, like the facial expressions, the eyes. I think Tangal does the best there. There are just certain pairings I really love. Al Milgrom's a great choice. I love when Joe Sinnott would ink him on the Avengers in the 80s, because it looked like modern day Kirby. Everybody was sort of thick and had quads that could knock out a giant, So, and then it's funny when it doesn't work, right? Like I think about the 90s, there were parts where they tried to have Jim Aparo, who's my favorite Batman artist of all time, inked by Bill Sienkiewicz, who's this crazy, revamps the New Mutants, Stray Toasters, Elektra Assassin artist. And that was not two tastes that tasted well together. Like that was not both those guys are legends. They did not work well together. So anyway, quick aside, but I just, shout out to inkers. They deserve some love.
When it comes to art, I know what I like and what looks good. And just speaking of this issue, Dick Giordano and Perez together on this make it look beautiful.
So. Oh yeah. These guys are on the Mount Rushmore of bronze and further age artists. They're amazing. So Keith, every episode before we jump into the issue proper opens with a segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth. And this is where the guest and I each grab Diana's Golden Lariat and tell one silly little truth about ourselves so that the listeners can get to know us a little better. Since you're the guest, I will let you go first. So why don't you start us off?
I had a couple of different ideas on this. I think I'm going to go with the one that will tell on me. I'm going to go ahead and keep in mind I was 8 years old when this happened.
So. I'm excited already.
So anyway, I have a sister who's 8 years older than me. So think about this: she's 16, I'm 8, and we were basically raised by two different sets of parents, even though it was the same parents, it seems. So we didn't get along growing up. We get along great now. I mean, we're buds now. But like, she was dealing with an 8 year old. I was dealing with a 16 angsty person who was much bigger than me and used to beat the crap out of me all the time. Yeah, like just that's just what was the nature of the game. So we were always doing things to each other to get under each other's skin. And I came home one day, I got off the bus. Normally she was there to meet me, but she wasn't. Walked home and she's standing on the back porch and there's a boy there and they're both smoking cigarettes.
Oh.
And I was like, yeah, this is my chance. So I went up to her and I was like, hey, sis, you're not supposed to have boys here or be smoking. And she said, well, don't tell mom and dad. I was like, I won't tell them if you let me taste what that cigarette tastes like.
Oh.
Yeah. So she gave it to me. And a little while later, parents came home and I was puking my guts out.
Oh, no.
And my mom asked me what happened. I was like, Beverly made me smoke a cigarette while she had a boy over at the house.
Oh, man.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Can you cuss on here?
Yeah, that's fine. Totally fine.
Yeah, but I was a little back then. Some say I'm a big now. But anyway, that's my lasso of truth. I've already apologized to her for the past 45 years about that. But yeah, she still brings that up at every opportunity that she can bring it up.
That is awesome. And that is such a great, so I'm a little brother too. I have two older sisters. One is 6 and one is 7 years older than me. So I have very much lived in that pocket of like, you are so busted. that's so great. Oh my God. That's so awesome. I love that. And then being a kid and being like, well, you have to let me try the cigarette. Like, oh, that's not going to go well.
Yeah.
So let me ask a question just real quick, if you don't mind. Did that experience, did you ever smoke in your life, or did that experience turn you off at such an early age that you never smoked?
Oh, well, I was a sickly kid. That explains why, you know, I was inside reading comic books all the time, but I did play a lot of sports because back then it was like, get the kid outside, get him running and stuff like that. And it'll help out his asthma. So I played every sport just because I had to. But yeah, when I got to college, the asthma had pretty much gone away.
Okay.
And by then I discovered drinking. And of course, you know, this is like early 90s. Everybody smoked.
Oh, yeah.
At college. So it happened. But normally when I was drinking, and it was just, yeah, I eventually just gave it up just because I was tired of my mouth tasting like an ashtray. So.
Yeah, it's funny. Those early experiences I bet you can still taste that first cigarette. It's so gross. Well, that's an awesome lasso of truth moment. In fact, you've inspired me. I'm going to change. I had something else written down, but since you're talking older sister, younger brother moments, I've got, like I said, two older sisters. So I'm going to grab the lasso of truth and tell a tale about my sisters. And I would say abusing me. They would say giving me what I deserve. And they're probably right. So my parents, my dad was sort of in and out of our lives, mostly out. And my mom worked two jobs. So my older sisters effectively helped to raise me. And, you know, I was a little brother. Like, it was like any little brother. And I think I was 6. And we were home, and we just had been – we lived in Oregon at the time, and it was the winter. There was like an ice storm. We had just been cooped up too long together, and I was really, really enjoying pissing them off. Like, it was real, like I woke up that morning and chose violence. I was like, my goal today is to make my older sisters angry, and I know where the boundary is, and I'm going to shoot right by it and see how far I can get. So at one point, they're sitting down, and I think they're, like, listening to an album, and they're talking about something. You know, we're all, again, we're stuck in the house because there's, like, an ice storm outside. And they're talking, and I'm on the couch reading comics, and I keep, like, reaching over and pinching them. And not like playful, tickle, or goofy, like trying to see if I can actually leave a bruise pinch. I don't know why. I don't know what, I don't know what prompted this, what I was reading or what, but I do it once. And my older sister was like, ow. She's like, do not do that again. And I do, my middle sister, I do it. She's like, stop it. And I do, I mean, I must've done it, you know, five times. And finally they say to me, if you do that again, like, we're going to do something that you basically, you'll never do it again. And I was like, oh, what's that? And I went to go do another pinch. And my older sister does a, like a Hurricane Rana off the top rope. I mean, it's like a John Cena, like, you know, she like picks me up and then like lands me on my back. I mean, literally it was like being choked out by the Undertaker, just throws me flat on the ground. Sits like puts her knees on my arms, and while she's doing this insane wrestling move, my middle sister runs to the kitchen, and they had been making dinner for us. Now my middle sister loves, I'm Mexican, and my middle sister loves refried beans, and I'm a bad Mexican because I hate refried beans. I always have. In fact, they disgust me and are the food I'm like most grossed out by. So she comes running in with a pot of refried beans and a wooden spoon. I am pinned to the ground and they start force feeding me refried beans. And I'm like, stop, stop. And they are like shoving the wooden spoon in my mouth and they're putting the refried beans in my mouth and covering my mouth until I have to swallow them, you know, and I'm like, oh, stop, stop, stop. And I finally, you know, and they're like, we told you to stop pinching us. We told you. And so, I mean, it felt like forever. And definitely in my mind, this was like a slow motion, you know, dramatic scene from a movie, you know, with, you know, some sort of high pitched woman's voice in the background. And, you know, this like fall from grace where I'm forced to eat refried beans. And they finally, you know, stand up and I get up and I wipe my face and I'm crying and mad at them. And they're like, we told you what we would do. And I'm like, I'm going to tell mom. And they're like, fine, tell mom. And so I go running to my room and I'm furious and I feel like I've been mistreated worse than anybody's ever been mistreated in the history of the world. And I'm, you know, I can taste refried beans in my mouth, which is disgusting. But I decide not to like clean my face because I want my mom to see the evidence of the crime. Like, I want it to be really driven home for her what these harpies did to me, you know, like how evil my older sisters are. So I'm in my room and I'm not, you know, washing my face, but I also won't read any comics because I don't want to get brief fried beans on them. So I'm just kind of sitting there by myself. And I don't know how many hours go by. My mom is working and I fall asleep and she comes home and like checks in on me and then like, you know, goes, talks to my sisters, whatever. And then the next morning I come bounding out, you know, and I see my face in the bathroom mirror and I'm like, oh yeah. And I go running and I'm like, mom, I'm like, do you know why my face is dirty? And she's like, yeah, your sisters told me. I'm like, what did they tell you? And they're like, oh, you know, they told me that you got so excited by the dinner they made and you ate really quickly and it upset your stomach and you went right to bed. And she's like, I was really surprised that you went to bed without all that in your face. You're usually not that dirty. And I'm like, no. And I'm about to tell her the truth. And they are standing behind her holding a wooden spoon, like smacking their hands, like schoolyard bullies. And I make a business decision in that moment. And I decide I am not going to tell on my sisters. And I have to say, one, it was a smart decision because they would have enacted evil revenge. But two, it was actually kind of the start of me covering for them and it turning out to be beneficial for me because they threatened me, which is why I didn't tell on them about the refried beans. But then like later that day or later that week, they walked me over to 7-Eleven and like bought me a comic book for my silence. And I suddenly was like, oh, wait a minute. Nice. There's transaction in this. And if I can cover for them, I can get more comics. And at that age, there was really nothing I wouldn't do to get more comics. So anyway, that is that's my evil older sister's moment. I like that we had a common theme in ours. Oh, yes. That's so funny.
getting over on your sibling is a sport. Actually, it's a blood sport. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. My sister was around 16 when that happened, and she had gotten her license, and it finally dawned on me that she could drive me places.
Exactly. Oh yeah. Yeah, it's fun when they become useful suddenly, when you're like, oh, wait a minute, you're not just a tormentor. You can drive me to, you know, like, I mean, if, you know, back in the day, for those of us who collected comics in the 80s, you know, you had your normal convenience stores you hit up. But then there were those brief, beautiful moments where you got to a mall and you got to like a Walden Books, you know, or like, I don't know what the, did you have like a bookstore in the mall that sold comics? That was always fun.
Yeah, there was a newsstand at one of the malls that sold some comics where I could I think that's where I first started seeing like the Baxter stuff was a newsstand versus like the Quick Pick that was down at the corner that I could walk to where I could pick up a pocket full of Noun Laters and a couple of comics off the spinner rack. And we also had at the fairgrounds every Saturday there was the flea market.
Oh yeah.
And that's how I found out that there were actually comic book stores, because these guys would bring their old books and set up stands at the flea market to sell on the weekends. And then I found out that there was an actual specialty comic book place that wasn't that far from my neighborhood. I could walk there. It was a long walk, but I eventually got either my sister or my mom to drive me there, and, you know, found out about subscriptions, found out,
yeah,
you know, the comics came out on a certain day, and I could get them to actually hold it for me. So I mean, it was the most wondrous time of the world.
I still remember that. I remember the first time, discovering there was an entire store devoted to this thing that I loved, and then seeing one and going into it was better than going to Disneyland for the first time. Like, it was, you know, like, you opened the door, this like angelic music played, and you were like, oh my God, I'm not alone in this. There, and then, yeah, having a box and a pull list and not being at the whim of the spinner rack was, yeah, it's life altering. So thanks for joining me in the Lasso of Truth. We're going to jump to the issue. Right. And again, this is issue 17 of volume 2 of Wonder Woman. It's called Traces. And we see Diana and Vanessa off to meet Julia in Greece. Diana wants to see modern Greece for the first time. And while there, she is welcomed with love and fanfare, visiting ancient sites and sensing their power and the presence of the gods. Meanwhile, a magical evil is watching nearby and will attack Diana before she can make a move. While all this is happening, the Greek gods are reeling from Darkseid's attack on Olympus in Action Comics 600. Hercules wants to take the fight back to Darkseid, but Zeus has other plans, which involves a new Olympus for the gods. Speaking of the gods, the Amazons are worried about their silence of late. We know this because Hippolyta writes a naked letter to Diana and sends it to her on a flying rat. Meanwhile, in America, Steve and Etta's romance continues to grow, while Mindy Mayer seems to be coming apart at the seams. So, Keith, let's take a look at the cover of this issue. I'm really curious about your thoughts, because it's an unusual cover in its construction. And so why don't you describe it for the listeners and let us know what you think?
All right. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's a sunrise or sunset, but you can tell it's kind of a peaceful look. We're looking, I think, at the back of Diana or her silhouette as she's facing the sun with her bracelets crossed in the air, which she did before Wakanda Forever.
Definitely, yeah.
she's standing what looks like at some ruins, Greek ruins, and facing the sun, and it just says Traces. A lot of it is like negative space, like the dark of the columns and the in the shadows of the sun. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at this, and it's, as far as the cover goes, it's I love it, but there's not a lot of action. And at this time I was reading enough comics to know, hey, this is like a transition issue just by looking at the cover between two action-packed storylines, because we just came off Silver Swan, getting ready to go into some more stuff with another one of her classic villains. Mm-hmm. But looking back at it now and rereading it, I really think that that's a sunset instead of a sunrise, because of what we read later, what you mentioned, you know, the Greek gods are planning on moving their base of operations and kind of going away from Earth. Like, maybe this is saying to us, Diana's staying and going to be the beacon of the gods here on Earth, as they draw away a little bit from the people of Earth.
That's an amazing observation. Yeah, that's really, really a great observation of Diana as the sort of last connection to the Greek gods. I mean, it actually, it's funny, you were saying that, and I was like, oh, I think you're 100% right. And I think the cover itself is doing something like that too, which is you have this beautiful, again, sunset or sunrise. I think you're right, it is a sunset because of that theme. And there's this black strip right down the middle of the cover, which is supposed to be a column, right? An Ionic or Doric column. And on the left, you have the Greek ruins. And on the right, you have Diana praying. And it's almost saying, like, the left side of this is the past. And this is ancient Greece and, you know, where the Greek gods thrived. But on the right, this is their surviving element. This is, you know, Wonder Woman is the modern day piece. So it's almost like cutting from the past to the present. You're right. It's like saying every other trace of them is fading and they're even going to remove themselves from this reality, it sounds like. But Diana will remain to sort of carry on their name and, you know, and their good work. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, good with a giant question mark work, but I think that's a brilliant analysis. And I love, it's funny. I love this cover, even though, now I can tell you why, because that was a really great analysis of it. But I think part of it too is just, I love the color blocking of it. I love the audacity of Perez, who's, you know, one of the three best cover artists of all time, being like, oh, I'm not going to draw a face on this. I'm not going to draw, you know, I'll draw the silhouette of a character, but I'm not going to actually draw Diana. I'm going to let the colorist really sing. Like, I'm going to let Carl Gafford or Tatiana Wood, rest in peace, Tatiana Wood, she just passed away. But I'm going to let, you know, one of those two, whoever's coloring the cover here, really sing with this beautiful yellow and then the contrast of the stark black silhouette. So I think it's really cool. I don't, you know, I mean, I bought it as a kid because I collected this series, but I don't know if I would have, as a young kid, I don't know if it would have jumped out at me and gotten my, you know, 75 cents. But as an adult, it really catches my eye because it's so different than everything else Perez is doing.
Oh yeah, and majority black covers, just like white covers, kind of pop when they're there on the stands. So I think it would have drawn the eye. I think the subtlety of it though, like, you know, if I had been 6 or 7 instead of 16 when I bought this, it wouldn't have drawn me because I like when I was a kid, like all kids, I like as many characters as possible beating the crap out of each other on. Or big gorillas or dinosaurs or something, you know. So, but yeah, it was subtle, and it's actually the way Perez draws her silhouette. I mean, you can tell it's Diana, even though she's clearly not in her normal uniform. She's in some flowing robes. I mean, yeah, the lasso of truth glowing at her hip kind of is a giveaway. But you know, they always say good artists can draw a character in silhouette and you still know who the character is. So
that's a great point. And, you know, for anybody who's a Marvel fan at this point, it kind of looks like she's wielding the Star Brand from New Universe. So, you know,
New Universe was hitting around this time. Yeah.
I think New Universe was probably dying around this time. It came and went pretty quickly, but no, it's a really beautiful cover. And again, you know, doing this podcast, one of the things that's wonderful about doing an index show is you, for the first, you know, you do a real deep dive all along the way with each step. And I have to say, George's covers for this book have lent to the busier side, you know, but Perez busy, where, you know, each piece of rubble is a work of art. And then there's these little punctuated moments where he does something like this, and he's like, oh, let me remind you of my range. Like, let me show you what else I can do here. And I especially like it because it's also the first issue that he writes himself, that he is the full writer of. And you know, now at this point in, you know, 2026, I've read a lot of works where George was the writer. I mean, you know, including one of the few New 52 books that I liked when New 52 landed was his Superman book, not because I loved what they were doing with Superman, but his Superman book written and drawn by him. And it was only, I think he was only on it for like maybe 8 or 9 issues, but it was a dense read where everything else in New 52, I felt like I was back at, you know, 1991 Image Comics, for good and for bad. his book had, like, it took me like more than 3 minutes to read. Like, there was real density, there was thought, character. And so, you know, I think Perez as a writer is really into character development. And he has something in common with Chris Claremont, where he loves a good, you know, in meanwhile issue. He loves a good, like you said, between the big battles, we're going to slow everything down. We're going to check in on our main character and her supporting cast so that this feels like a really rich and lived in world. So I love it. Did you notice anything different in this issue, having it been written fully by Perez, or did it feel very kind of in line with what's come before?
Yeah, going back and reading this, I think, well, I'm pretty sure when I first read it, I had no clue that it was his first time writing. But since then, you know, it's always seemed to me the better an artist is, the more, just as a general, they should not write, just because it seems like if the artist is really into detail, they seem to think that the detail, maybe it's an insecurity or something, but they seem to think that the detail in their art is not going to get across to readers. And since they're the writer now, they try and put as many words in there in detail as they did in the art, and they really don't need to. You can kind of see a little bit of this in this first stab with him with Ryder, because it's very, very verbose, very, very word heavy. But I didn't have a necessarily a problem with it, and he gets better with it the more he writes throughout the years. He starts cutting down on words, letting the art, you know, finding that balance, mm-hmm. rather than trying to be detailed in both art and words. But yeah, I just think that him doing double duties on this was a great first effort for him. And, you know, it is wordy, but, you know, around this time I was reading, you know, some Roy Thomas stuff too. And that's as wordy as it gets.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. I mean, there's Claremont wordy, and, you know, that's, and then there's, you know, Roy Thomas wordy. Yeah, that's yeah. I love Roy's so funny for me, because I love him. I think he's one of the, you know, he's one of the great comic book great creators of all time, and he was the first fan. He, you know, created continuity basically, and in Roy's better moments, I love him. I love a lot of All-Star Squadron, but when Roy starts like showing his dissertation in comics, when he's like, hey, look at the PhD program I'm working on, you know, that's when it's like, oh god, dude, you know, what are you doing, man? It's so funny. So I have a question. This is not a secret question, but we can call it one. So Perez is writing and drawing this issue, and we talked about, you know, him doing that very successfully. Do you have a favorite artist slash writer comic book creator? Do you have a favorite creator who does both and you think does both really well?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think of some, but
I can go first if you want. I'll give you time to think.
Yeah. That'd be good.
So you know, there are some big ones that jump out at me, but I'm going to actually go modern. I'm going to go with Daniel Warren Johnson. I don't know if you know how familiar every listener will be with him. He is a modern day writer and artist. He wrote for Image. He did the Do a Power Bomb miniseries, which is this amazing, amazing mini where there is a galactic wrestling competition, and you have to win it, and you get whatever wish you want granted. And it's this really sad story about a woman, a girl who lost her mom and wants to wrestle to save her. And but his art is thick and kinetic and really, really, I mean, it's like Walt Simonson, Jack Kirby, and Bill Sienkiewicz all did coke together and fused into one like coke-headed amazing artistic being. He most recently has been doing the Transformers book for Skybound for Image, but he is one of my favorite modern creators. I buy anything he writes or draws. Most famously recently, he did the main story art and writing in the Absolute Batman annual that came out a couple months ago. And so, you know, some people who are collecting Absolute Batman might be familiar with him, but he is phenomenal. I cannot recommend his stuff enough. Again, he wrote Wonder Woman Dead Earth and drew it, which is amazing. Highly would recommend his Transformers run. I'd highly recommend his Do a Powerbomb book. And then there's another book he did for Image that I absolutely love, which is about a rock guitarist, a guy who wants to become the best rock guitarist of all time. Like, he's kind of that guy. He's like, if Jack Black were a penciler, it would be Daniel Warren Johnson. So anyway, for those of you who know him, you know him. If you're unfamiliar, I highly suggest checking his work out. He is phenomenal. Okay, so what about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to check out some of his stuff. That sounds really interesting, especially the rock guitarist one. But yeah, so for me, I've read some Savage Dragon, so Eric Larson.
Oh, there you go.
Does a good job on that. I keep meaning to go back and read the entire series, but I think I'm going to save that for when I retire, when I have all the time in the world, because there's so many issues to go back on. But I'd probably go with Frank Miller, I think.
Yeah.
Daredevil, Sin City is just one thing that every couple of years I just go back through and reread it. And I'd probably pick Frank Miller or early Frank Miller, like maybe, before he did the follow up
Dark Knight Returns. Yeah.
Yeah. Pre that and pre the All-Star Batman stuff, Frank Miller. Yeah.
That's a great choice. Yeah. So I blanked for a second. The title of the rock guitar miniseries is Murder Falcon. And actually, let me just, for you and for the rest, let me just read you the description of this. It's a comic book series about a down on his luck musician named Jake, who teams up with a giant, powerful monster fighting bird named Murder Falcon to fight monsters threatening Earth, with Jake's guitar shredding, fueling the creature's power. So I cannot recommend Daniel Warren Johnson enough, but yeah, Frank Miller, huge. I would say David Lapham, Lapham. He did like Stray Bullets. He did a bunch of work for Valiant. Jim Shooter discovered him in the 90s. So if you're a fan of the 90s Valiant stuff, like Harbinger, he was all over that. He's really amazing. I mean, John Byrne, his Fantastic Four run is on the Mount Rushmore of Fantastic Four runs. He's got to be up there as well. And, there are just so many amazing and talented writer and artists. And George obviously is, in my opinion, the best, but there's a lot of others as well. So the other reason I really like this issue with George taking over on writing is the last two issues felt more like Len Wein showcases. They felt very Bronze Age-y. They felt very like Codename Assassin or Human Target, sort of pre-Peter Milligan Human Target, but they felt very Bronze Age-y. And I enjoyed that, but I definitely didn't want the book to go that direction. So for George to take the reins and have it go back to what I've loved about this book all along, which is layered storytelling and a huge focus on Greek mythology, it makes me really happy. And so, speaking of Greece, Diana, Vanessa Kapitellis, not my favorite character, and are going to modern day Greece to visit Julia, Vanessa's mom, and her Julia's special friend Stavros. I'm not really sure what the relationship is with Julia and Stavros. I'm sure Brett Young will have some commentary on that when we read the issue. But they're off to see modern-day Greece. And this is my favorite part of the issue, because the Greeks really lay out the welcome mat for Diana. And the Greek prime minister even arranges for Diana to go visit, like, the Parthenon, the Acropolis, all these famous ruins on her own, like, clears the path for her. And if anybody who's ever traveled knows, that's a pretty amazing thing, because you don't get to see these things on your own. You're usually surrounded by 500 sweaty tourists just like you. And so she goes and she senses the traces of her gods there. It resonates with her. So Keith, this actually does bring me to my first official secret question of the issue. So in this issue, Diana goes to visit the ancient ruins of Greece, including the Parthenon. While there, she senses her own history and the power of the Greek gods. Do you have a favorite historical landmark, a monument, a ruin, some sort or place that you love to visit or have had a chance to visit? And why did it resonate with you emotionally? And I can go ahead. If you need some time, I can go first.
Go ahead and go first, because yeah.
Okay, so it's a loaded question, but I'm excited to hear the answer. So I have, I've been very fortunate. I've talked about this on the show before. I've traveled quite a bit because I'm a teacher, And earlier in my career, when I was a younger man and had the stamina for this, I would chaperone trips over the summer to Europe with my students from my school. Me and a couple of other teachers would put these, it was a company called EF Tours, and you could sign up and you could chaperone and you would travel for free. So, I mean, I went to like 8 countries in 3 years for free. It was amazing. And one of those trips, we went to Delphi. We went to Greece, and we went to the Oracle at Delphi. We went to the caves where the oracles were said to say prophecies, the oracles of Apollo. And there's this thing in ancient Greek mythology called the navel of the world. It was this sculpture in Delphi, and they believed that it was the center of the world, that it was literally the center point of the world, and everything revolved around it. And then so in all of the Greek mythology I would teach the kids, I would talk to them about, you know, the oracles at Delphi, and I would talk to them about the navel of the world, and you know, these poor women who were in these caves inhaling basically like toxic gas, which is why they were speaking in tongues, and people thought they were speaking, you know, the god Apollo was speaking through them, and it was like, no, they just needed oxygen, like, you know, these poor women. But it was, you know, it carried all this weight for me. And I remember we went to Delphi, and I'm, you know, chaperoning, I've got, you know, 30 high school kids with me, and the tour guide, we go through this like amphitheater. And we're walking down, 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 and he turns a corner and he goes, oh, that statue's the navel of the world. And I don't know. I mean, it was this moment, even my kids who had my classical class as 10th graders, there was this palpable like gasp amongst us. And we felt like that moment of history. We felt like, God, this was the center of the world for so many years. This was the center of culture and philosophy and writing. And, you know, obviously, there were amazing things happening in other parts of the world and other cultures, but like, you know, America follows a Western tradition, and that is Greece. And I felt so overwhelmed by the history of it. And I felt like, God, this amphitheater, like people sat here and watched Antigone and watched Oedipus and watched, you know, Ovid and all those, I mean, just all of those great works. And I was really overwhelmed and moved by it to the point where like I was touching the statue. They would allow you to touch it. And my kids all came up and kind of touched it, the ones who'd had my class already. And we had this really cool just bonding experience of like feeling the power of history kind of shifting through us. So anyway, that's like one of my favorite places in the world. And I've had a chance to go back once, and I just, it's, you know, I don't know that everybody who goes to Greece goes to Delphi, because I'll usually go to Athens, but Delphi is definitely worth the side trip. What about you?
Well, I am not a world traveler. In fact, the first time I ever left the country was for my honeymoon when we went to Jamaica.
Oh, nice.
And that was back in 98. And I finally got a passport like 3 years ago when the family, we went on a cruise because my twins graduated high school and my oldest one graduated college. So all 5 of us went on a cruise and I had to get a passport then. So I haven't traveled a lot. I've traveled the country. The U.S., but not outside of the country that much. It's kind of one of those things where, you know, we're making a list of places to go. When we retire and whatnot. But as far as significant historical landmark, this is a significant historical landmark for Franklin County, North Carolina, which is where I live. But yeah, right at the border of Franklin County and Wake County. Wake County is the county seat. It's where the capital of Raleigh is. All of the historic landmarks and stuff are pretty much in Raleigh or big cities across the state. But this particular one is weird enough to where I currently live on my grandfather's old farm in Franklin County, and walking distance is probably about 2 miles. From my house is where the man buried in the rock is. Oh. So just to let you know what this is, this dude, William Jeffries, he was a North Carolina state senator from Franklin County. And when in the mid 1800s. Okay. So when he got close to death, he had some sort of fever where his mind went toward the end. And he was really worried about premature burial and, you know, the worms underground.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Stuff like that. So he begged his father to make sure that he was buried in a rock. So his dad honored his request and found this 20-foot boulder, which is near my house in the woods. And he had a stonemason hollow it out, and they buried him in a mahogany casket in there. And up at the top of that 20-foot tall boulder, there was glass at the top where you could see the casket. And his tombstone was mounted at the top of it. Well, you know, that was the 1800s. Over the years, it became a place where kids would go and drink and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it got ruined. And, you know, they had to replace the headstone a bunch of times. And it's on private property. Eventually, they kind of walled it off, but they fenced it in. And, you know, I'd heard things of, you know, shotguns going off in the middle of the night to scare people off, you know.
Oh, wow.
But it's real near my house, and if you talk to the family, you can go, but you can walk back there and see it. They don't let anybody climb up on it anymore. But it's just one of those things. There used to be a you know how they had those state historical markers by the side of the road. I don't know
if anybody
does that, but yeah, there used to be one there telling people where it was. But probably about 5, 6, 7 years ago, they removed it because the family asked the state to remove it because too many people were coming there and disturbing this man's grave, which is inside this boulder. But anyway,
so cool.
Yeah. They have no trespassing signs up everywhere. And, you know, it's just a neat place to know that the man in the rock is close to where my family grew up. It is like right up the road. So
that is so cool. I love, you know, because of the sheer size of America, like the land mass and the scope of our history, you know, the way it's developed, you know, kind of westward movement. I've always lived in the West. So everything in my life, you know, around me is relative, you know, geographically relatively young, right? Like I remember I was on a college tour at University of Arizona in Tucson. I live in Phoenix. I went to Arizona State, but I was considering going to U of A. And I was down there doing a college tour when I was, you know, a teenager. And they were pointing to this building, and they're like, "That building is 100 years old." And I remember being like, "Oh!" And I remember somebody in the group laughing, and they're like, "Sorry, I'm from the East Coast. Like, my apartment's 100 years old." They're like, you know, like this. There's, you know, that's not history relative to, you know, the rest of the country. But it's cool. And
people in Europe are laughing at us.
Oh, they're, yeah, like, exactly. Like, even that is, but
the thing, 200 years old, ooh.
Yeah. But the thing you can't beat with America versus other countries are our weird, like, you know, world's biggest ball of twine, you know, like all our, we are the Lizzie Borden house, you know, the Amityville house, like the things you can't beat are those weird stories. I now want to see the man in the rock. That is so cool. Yeah, like what a cool story.
Yeah. I'll send you, I'll see if I can find an article about it and I'll send it to you.
That's like, awesome. That's seriously so cool, man. I've never heard of this. I love this. That's awesome. I'm shocked that like Neil Gaiman didn't have him in a Sandman story or something in the, you know, in the '90s. Like that's just, that is so cool. So we'll cut back to Diana and she lands in Greece and there's all this fanfare, but there is a man trying to reach her. And we don't know why. We don't know if he's threatening her, if he's trying to get something to help her. But he is gruesomely murdered, it appears, by animals while Diana is being sort of led off with all this fanfare. And there is this ominous – these scenes ominously cutting to a woman on an aisle with these long blood-red fingernails talking about, you know, she doesn't like the Amazon being that close to her. It's making her feel threatened. She's fought the Amazons before, which is telling because this woman then must be, you know, centuries old. If this is before the Amazons were on Paradise Island. And so we, you know, so I'm going to spoil. We don't know, learn this in the issue, but we find out, you know, this is going to be the post-crisis introduction of one of Wonder Woman's great villains, Circe. So I'm super excited that we're in the Circe place here. And we're getting this light introduction to her. Do you have any history with this character at all?
Circe, yes. The main thing I remember her from was JLA story where Circe, they had to go back in time to find the Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
And I think Speedy was the one who was stuck at Circe's island.
Uh-huh.
And he was a centaur or something, I believe. But yeah, that I think was my first clue into to Cersei. So, but yeah, so and that's our first, one of our first images of her, like you said, is like her hands. You see her in silhouette.
Yeah,
she's making some sort of potion for her to drink with like liquid dripping off of those long fingernails. So it clearly tells you that she is some sort of witch of some sort. When she's drinking that. But I guess I have a question for you now.
All right, yeah. Yeah, let's do it.
So if Superman's main foe is Lex Luthor and the Joker is Batman's, my question for you is, who is Wonder Woman's? You know, she has Ares, Cheetah, Cersei. Is it someone else? Is there someone that sticks out to you as being her, if it had to be one kingpin villain for Wonder Woman, who would it be?
That is a great question. And it's funny because let me marinate for a second, if you don't mind.
Well, yeah. Just for me, just because, you know, the Battle of the Super Friends, the is really in my head. It's always been the Cheetah. Whether it's the way she talks, which is kind of a sing-song cat thing. Maybe it was resonating with me as a young male kid. I hadn't quite reached the age to know what that entails. You know, Catwoman, the Cheetah. Mm-hmm. You know how that affects the male mind. But yeah, she always just seemed just absolutely ferocious in that. You know, Wonder Woman was always a thinker. She could always think her way out of a lot of situations. But the Cheetah was just raw power, scratch your eyes out kind of stuff. So,
but yeah, I think Cheetah's a great choice. My favorite version of the Cheetah is Perez's. It's the Barbara Minerva,
yep,
really animalistic Cheetah, and it's such a nice contrast to Diana. You know, Diana is all about control, precision, patience, love, compassion. Cheetah is just a bloody animal who will tear you apart. So there, I mean, that's a great choice. And I, you know, I think Ares for me, it always comes back to Ares for me because, you know, he is the embodiment of war and that dark side of war, right? Even in Greek mythology, Athena is the goddess of the like strategic side of war. Ares is the bloody side of it. So he really stands in contrast to Diana, and he's all about that sort of unchecked power. And I love that added layer of he is still her god. You know, like no matter how much she has to oppose him, no matter how much his philosophies are anathema to her, at the end of the day, he's still one of her deities. So I love Ares. But I'm gonna say, so Ares would be my choice, but I'm gonna actually do a quick shout out to the current Wonder Woman run by Tom King and Daniel Semper, which I know is dangerous on this network. I take chances with my life on this network almost monthly in my defense of Tom King. But the current Wonder Woman run, with the exception of the most recent Mouse Man arc, which might be one of the things I hate most in the world. Prior to that, though, and coming after it, King and Semper have built this new villain for her called the Sovereign. And he's basically like the secret king of America. Like he and his family have actually like secretly ruled all of the world and been behind the scenes, and in America in particular, are like the true controlling power. And it feeds every fun conspiracy theory that's ever, you know, jumped into your brain and everything you've ever suspected about how, you know, corrupt and crazy the truly wealthy must be. And it's this awesome, awesome villain who's all about like control and people bowing to him. And, you know, there's definitely an air of sort of patriarchy to it, but more than that, it's really about lie versus truth. He embodies the lie of the world because he's actually been in control of it for centuries and no one knows that. And you know, Wonder Woman's all about exposing the truth. So yeah, for me, it's Ares. Cheetah's probably the other great choice, but I'm going to give a quick shout out to Sovereign. I love that question though, because I think Diana has an undervalued rogues gallery. I think it's gotten really good post Perez and other writers, you know, or with Perez and post Perez and other writers have carried that too. And so I love it. I do have a kind of just a little follow-up question about Cersei, though. So we're going to get this. This is a very light introduction in this issue to post-crisis Cersei. But there are actually now two other really pronounced versions of this character in comics. I don't know if you're familiar with the Cersei, the Avenger in Marvel. Yeah, she's an Eternal, and then she joins the Avengers at one point, and she is like one of the three main characters during the Leather Jacket Avengers in the 90s, the Bob Harris, Steve Epting Avengers. I know not everybody loves that era. I do. It's one of my favorite eras. It's, you know, Black Knight with a mullet and Crystal and Cersei, and there's this whole love triangle. And so I love that version of her as the sort of hero, but a hero who could lose it at any minute. And then I don't know if you're reading, how much you read modern comics, but, you know, DC has this Absolute line that they launched about a year and a half ago, Absolute Batman, Absolute Superman, Wonder Woman. And it's effectively, people say like, oh, it's DC's Ultimate Universe. It kind of, but there's an interesting spin. It's basically, what if Darkseid created the universe? So Darkseid leaves our universe, takes this great power with him, and basically starts his own universe. And so where, you know, in our universe, you would assume the DNA of everything that happens is sort of hopefully this inherent goodness. In that universe, everything down to like the atomic level has some dark side in it. So everything's like extra dark and extra scary. So heroism has to like take new forms. And in that universe, the Absolute Wonder Woman book, which is amazing. It's Kelly Thompson is the writer. Hayden Sherman's the artist. And it is, I think it's going to go down as one of the best books of the decade, in particular because of Sherman's art, though Kelly Thompson's writing is phenomenal. But in that universe, the Amazons are gone. No one knows where they are. And Diana is, as a baby, is given to Cersei, the witch of the Wild Isle in Hell. And Cersei raises Diana. Cersei is, for all intents and purposes, Diana's mother. And she's a sorceress, and she teaches Diana sorcery. So the Wonder Woman of the Absolute Universe has Amazonian powers, but is also a sorceress. And that the Cersei of that universe is like her mom, effectively. And like, you cannot help but fall in love with her. So it's really funny to me to encounter this very evil version of Cersei when my modern palette for that character is colored by two very different depictions of her. Are you familiar with the Absolute Universe at all?
I keep my toe, my pinky toe in modern comics. I read some things. I know what was going on with the Absolute Universe and Darkseid and everything. And I've heard good things about some of the titles, especially the Wonder Woman title, but I haven't dove in yet.
Dove is good. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't jumped in on a lot of that yet. It's on kind of my to-do list, just because I like to be knowledgeable of what's going on, you know, whenever I meet up with folks. So I am interested in that Sovereign character from the
Kingdom. Yeah.
It sounded like he's basically the Illuminati all rolled into one.
He is. And he's got, it's really good. That book, I'm a Tom King fan, so, you know, I know that's not everybody. Daniel Sampere is a great artist. When that book is focused on that arc, and that's like the first 19 issues, it's brilliant. It takes a little side quest, the last few issues on this other arc, which is maybe one of my least favorite comic books I've ever read, but it's now back to the other story, which I'm liking. So yeah, I recommend that highly. Absolute Wonder Woman in particular, for listeners, Hayden Sherman does the art. The other thing Hayden Sherman drew recently is the 12-issue Batman Dark Patterns miniseries. It was written by Dan Waters, who's a horror writer, and Hayden Sherman does the art. And it is unequivocally the best Batman story of the last 10 years. And there are people saying, like, 20 years from now, this is in the pantheon of, like, best Batman stories. And in large part, it's because of Sherman's art. So again, just recommendation for you, Keith, and for maybe some listeners. If you're not super plugged into modern comics, Batman Dark Patterns, it's a 12-issue miniseries. It's self-contained. It's set early in his career, so you don't need to know modern continuity. And Hayden Sherman is, 5 years from now, going to be this era's Mike Mignola. So I can't recommend it enough. Like, it's really great. And then Absolute Wonder Woman is as well. So yeah, so Cersei's coming. We're going to get one of Wonder Woman's big bads. And she actually attacks Diana. Diana's on a boat sailing by her island, but not intending to go there. And Cersei attacks her preemptively, and even Stavros picks up on, like, ooh, this is some dark magic. So we definitely have, you know, the setup for the next couple issues to come. While all that's going on, we do have Hippolyta on Themyscira giving an update to Diana, basically saying, hey, the Amazons are knee-deep in a debate, and this is a debate they've been having for a couple issues, about whether or not to open their doors to man's world and preach the Amazonian way. They actually have appointed one person who's for and one who's against, and they're all sort of talking and studying. And I love that. I think it's super interesting. And then there's a fun little moment in Hippolyta's letter to Diana. She's got a picture of Diana and Julia that Diana gave her. And Hippolyta's like, I'm in a very sweet way. She's like, I'm jealous of this woman because she's your mother in that other world. Like, she's acting maternally. She's like, I'm happy that you have her, but I also miss you and am a little jealous. And I thought that was a sweet moment. Like, what were your thoughts on Hippolyta's letter to Diana?
Yeah, I have a note here. Really, Hippolyta's letter, I think, is where George really shines as a writer in here, mm-hmm. because the letter feels so genuine from a mother to a daughter. You know, I know you're with this other lady who's kind of a mother figure to you. I hate not being there, you know, but and the whole discussion between should they stay hidden or should they not? I mean, just the entire letter, he just shines as just the genuineness and the emotion that he puts into it. It's like a mother actually writing to her daughter mm-hmm. in this situation. So,
do you, and this is too personal, I can cut this out. Do you have a favorite keepsake or memory of your mom or from your mom that you know, this may, you know, kind of warms your heart?
Well, my mom lives next door to me now, so
maybe not at the moment. Maybe a little too close.
but she was the one who always took me every week to the comic store. She would get off work. She worked a full time job. Both her and my dad did, and it was Wednesdays or maybe it was Thursdays then. I can't remember.
It was Thursdays. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was always on Thursday. She would take me to the comic store, and on the weekends, if I wanted to go to like that newsstand that's out at the mall or something like that, if she didn't have something else that she was doing, she would say, "Come on, let's go see if we can find you some books to read." Because my whole guess is that she was trying to keep me busy because I was kind of rambunctious. I would tear things up. And if I had a floor full of comics, you know, in the living room, all yep. spread out, then I wasn't destroying anything. So, yeah, that's probably my biggest memory. She's the reason that I became a comic lover. In fact, you know how Rob has his Mountain Comics and stuff. Uh-huh. We're beach comics. We went to the beach every year. My mom's uncle had a trailer down at Atlantic Beach in North Carolina, and we'd go down there for like 2 weeks at a time during the summer, and we'd go down there like weekend trips, like pretty much spent the summers down at the beach. But halfway in between Raleigh and Atlantic Beach is a town called New Bern, and there's this shop there called New Sport Shop. It's a big sporting goods place, rod and reels of both freshwater and saltwater, just guns and hunting equipment, all that kind of stuff. But my big reason for stopping there, well, my two big reasons. One reason was they had a little grill at the back that made the best cheeseburgers on the place.
That's awesome.
The other thing was they had a huge comic collection. They had spinner. They had like 10 checkout lanes, and there was a spinner rack at every checkout.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they had a side area that sold, like, you know, those trashy novels that your mom used to read and all that stuff. And plus they had more comics over there, but you know, like the Mad magazines and stuff like that, they kept over there, the bigger size stuff. But I would always go there, and she would tell me, we're on the way to the beach. And she's like, all right, you can get four things. Here you go. Here's the money for it. And I had to decide, you know, what to get. It was always, of course, a JLA or with the most characters on the cover, you know, Flash, Green Lantern, stuff like that. But yeah, New Sport Shop on the way to the beach, I guess, if I were to pinpoint a comic memory.
with that's her. So cool. I've joked about this before. Paul Ken, who hosts DC Special Cast on the network, which is an awesome show. Paul's a great guy. He was a guest on an earlier episode, and we jokingly said we should start a new show called Shut Up and Read, where we invite guests on to tell stories of times their parents bought them or somebody bought them comics to get them to shut up and then talk about what comics they were. And I think it would be a hit, man, because I think all of us have those special memories of our parents, you know, or somebody being like, okay, hey, here, like my sister, like I said earlier, my sister's bribing me. You know, I fielded the calls from their high school to say they had ditched, you know, and didn't tell my mom I fielded those calls, and I would get a couple comic books out of it, you know? So it was like, it's just such a cool, I love that. That's awesome. Do you have a favorite mom in comics?
A favorite mom in comics? I'm trying to think, not really a mom, but an aunt would probably be Iris Allen.
Oh, that's good.
So yeah, I mean, a mother figure to Wally, you know,
yeah,
is probably where I'd land on that. Either that, or you know, there's always Clark's mom, you know, Ma Kent.
Yeah, yeah,
is kind of the archetype for motherly love.
I loved, you know, it's funny. I was never an Aunt May fan, in large part because of the way they depicted her. I mean, they made her the world's oldest, frailest woman. I mean, how that woman survived a stiff breeze, I don't know, you know, for decades. And
until
then
Doc Ock came along, I guess.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Survived a lot more then. But my favorite version of her is when J. Michael Straczynski in the early 2000s came on that book as the writer. John Romita Jr. was doing the art. And Straczynski has her discover Peter's secret identity. And that whole run with May, where Peter thought, oh, she's so frail, this would kill her. And then you find out she's a damn tough woman who, you know, raised this kid on her own, basically, who wasn't even her son. And, you know, and Peter's not exactly an easy kid to raise, given who he actually is. And you learn so much more about her. And I think part of that was also from Ultimate Spider-Man, the way Bendis and Bagley depicted Aunt May in that book. But I love that version of Aunt May, and I'm actually glad. I don't think she's ever gone back to like the frail, you know, oh goodness me, pearl clutcher that she was, you know, pre Straczynski, pre Ultimate Spider-Man. So yeah, so it's a very sweet part of this issue, you know, with Hippolyta really, really lamenting, you know, or missing Diana, not lamenting. And then again, I love that debate the Amazons are having. You know, do we or don't we open our shores? And, you know, every country goes through an isolationist phase or two or three or five. And so it's interesting to watch the Amazons going through that same piece. And then we have a couple more cutaway moments with some really important side characters. Etta and Steve have dropped Diana and Vanessa off at the airport to go to Greece. And Steve says to her, well, you know, what do you want to do with the rest of the day? And she's like, I'm going to go to the gym. He's like, you want to go burn calories off a different way? And she's like, I would love to. And I love that. I love that George is giving Etta and Steve, especially because Steve is supposed to be somewhat of an older man, he's giving them an active love life. You know, he's giving them an active life together. And it's kind of payoff for longtime Wonder Woman fans, because these are two characters who've been there since day one. And they're very different post-crisis, but George is letting them be happy. So I like that, too. I think they have a cute relationship. And then Mindy Mayer, and, you know, and it's funny because I read along with the show, but I remember where this is going because this hit me pretty hard when I was a kid. Mindy Mayer is starting to really spiral out of control. We see her drinking at work. We see her drunk at work. We see her attacking her friends, attacking everyone around her, even sort of Diana and Julia. And she's just spinning out of control. So kind of a dichotomy of two of the main, you know, of the supporting characters. What were your thoughts on the attention George gives to those characters?
I think he handled the Steve Trevor Etta Candy thing well for the choices that they made. I personally didn't like it then. I don't really care for it now with Steve Trevor being older and not being the love interest of Wonder Woman. Because, uh-huh, you know, Superman has Lois Lane, you know. Bruce has, you know, whoever it is at the moment, Vicki Vale or whoever. But, you know, I like the way that he handled Steve Trevor and Etta Candy here in that, you know, it's a snapshot of the times. Like I know you've talked previously about Etta losing the weight and stuff like that. Women were bombarded at this time with like,
yeah,
Jazzercise, yep, Jane Fonda's workout, all that stuff. There was a movement to get get women in shape, you know, even men in shape, because I remember seeing, you know, like Venice Beach on MTV, you know, there was a movement to get people working out a lot more, you know, Tybo or whatever the heck. But as far as Steven Etta, I see them. It just doesn't quite fit in my brain. But that's more my brain problem. It seems like Lois Lane and Steve Lombard have gotten together. So
you know, that's funny.
Yeah, but yeah, I think he handles it well in what he does here with them, and it's the relationship they're developing seems to be, you know, wholesome. Seems to be, you know exactly what you need if you're not going to have Wonder Woman in a relationship. They kind of hinted at something with her and Superman, and there was that thing in Action 600 that was a brief thing where they were going to see if they could get together, you know, these two godlike figures as a ship, or as the kids say these days, or whatever. But that didn't work out. They realized they were friends and all that kind of stuff. So if you're not going to have a relationship with Wonder Woman right now, it's good to have a relationship in the comics, because otherwise you have like you have Vanessa and Barry, you know, is your only other thing. And I think it's clear from here. I haven't read ahead, but I'm pretty sure that Eileen is going to try and steal Barry while Vanessa's in Greece. So
it's definitely implied that her friend, that whole phone call with Vanessa and her friend is so gross. But I mean, it rings true. It rings very much like middle school girls, you know, kind of fighting. But it's really ugly, and then it compounds it at the fact that, one, Vanessa's so annoying, and then two, Perez puts her in Geordi LaForge glasses, you know, on the drive to the airport, which just made me want her. Like there was a moment in this book where I went, I'm glad you're going to be the Silver Swan in 20 years. I hate you.
Dude, I had a pair of those glasses. I wanted to wear one year. Yeah, I called them my Cyclops glasses.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that was like a thing for a hot minute back in the.
I remember it, but it was so funny because I was like, wow, that is a blast from the past. But yeah, it's funny. That's a really smart observation that Perez is almost using Steve and Etta as the outlet for a desire for romance, because he's not going to do that with Diana, which I actually really like. Michael Bailey and I talked about that the previous episode, which actually hasn't released as of this recording. So, but Michael Bailey and I cover Action 600, and we talk a lot about that sort of doomed relationship and whether it's a good thing it was doomed or not. So yeah, it's nice. This is a good issue though. It's a good sort of quiet, you know, meanwhile, but setting up the big Cersei arc to come, and is definitely, you know, I love it, actually. I don't know that anybody would say this is maybe their favorite issue of the series, but I love stories like this. I love the quieter moments where we get to know the characters better. And it feels like Diana's in really good hands again after the last couple of issues, the Silver Swan issues, which were really less than stellar. And it's nice to see a return to form for the series and to feel like, oh, okay, yeah, this is the series I love. And
I really like Stavros, too. He's introduced here, and you said that we don't know exactly his relationship with Julia, but you know, my guess is he's a professor in Greece that colleagues. I don't know, but he sets up their whole tour and stuff like that. But yeah, he's an interesting character with, especially the way that Perez draws him with his facial expressions and whatnot. So
yeah, I like him. It's funny because Vanessa calls him Uncle Stavros, so clearly he's been in her life for a long time. I definitely get the impression that he and Julia are lovers, not in a relationship necessarily, because in this issue, Julia talks for the first time about her husband who passed away. And that's interesting because, you know, I've always kind of wondered, because I was like, well, she's a Harvard professor, which it's not a bad job, but she's not going to make enough money to have all the different homes that she has that get destroyed. And so clearly she comes from some either family money or her husband who passed away had money. So I'm excited to learn a little bit more about him. I do think it's funny that one of the moments when she's talking about it, she's talking about his laugh and how brilliant he was. And then she's like, and huge hands. And I was like, subtle, Julia, really subtle. Wow. Yeah. But Stavros definitely is checking Diana out, and yeah, I like that. Yeah, he sort of lays out the itinerary for their visit, and I'm excited to see him a little bit more in the upcoming issues. He's I think going to be a fun character.
At this point, can I ask you a secret question?
Yeah, please do.
All right, so Stavros is the one who he tasked with planning this diplomatic itinerary or whatever it is for Diana to have a tour of Greece, some of the main highlights and stuff like that. So my question for you is, if a Stavros were to take you through the fictional U.S. of the DCU, what top landmarks would you make sure on that? Like, say, the top three landmarks. You can also change it up, and if not taking you, if he's bringing Diana and Julia to the U.S., like she just got there and he's taking her around, but yeah, what top places in the DCU would you make sure were mandatory stops?
This is such a damn good question. This might be my favorite secret question anybody's ever asked. This is so good. I need you to go first because I need a second to think. But this is seriously a top tier secret question. I'm super excited about this.
Oh yeah. So I mean, I've always been a Flash guy, so I would say the Flash Museum first.
Yeah.
Just to show either Diane or me, you know, what heroism is and what it is to be a hero in the DCU. I mean, looking at the Flash Museum is like key. And then the other one that really sticks out is you got to go to the Daily Planet. The Daily Planet is known around the world. You get good photo ops in front of the globe and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's Superman's hometown. He's the preeminent guy. And then coming up with a third one or something like that, you know, is the Hall of Justice around then? But I would probably, since she kind of has some ties to World War II, I would see if they could go to like the Black Hawk Island Museum, just to see like some of their World War II aviation stuff. You know, the legendary status of these just human soldiers who were heroes in their own right in World War II. But
that's really cool. Black Hawk Island's a really good pull. That's awesome. Yeah, this is tough because Daily Planet definitely would have been one of mine. Flash Museum would have been one of mine. So I'm going to go maybe a little dark. I would definitely want to go to Crime Alley in Gotham. I mean, I know that's super dark to be like, oh, hey, look, there are the chalk outlines of the Waynes. And, oh, hey, I found a pearl. But I it's one of the most resonant places in all of the DC universe. You know, I mean, it's like – it's got one of the best Super Friends episodes takes place there. And, I'd want to see, like, Leslie Tompkins Clinic. And, you know, so Crime Alley would definitely be one of them. And I'd like to be in Gotham long enough to see the Bat Signal, but not long enough to get Jokerized. So there's that. I would want to go to Madame Xanadu's and get my fortune read.
Ooh, that's
yeah. Cool. So like Greenwich Village, where, you know, she lived there with the Spectre and at one point in the 80s. But, yeah, definitely go to Madame Xanadu's and get my fortune read. For good or for ill. I think I would like to go, this is another kind of dark one, but I think it's Houma, Louisiana, where the Swamp Thing lives.
Down near the prison. The prison's down there
too. Yeah, well, I get to see Bell Rev. I'd get to see the Suicide Squad. I'd get to see the Swamp Thing, you know, and Abby Arcane and maybe Tefe if they've had their kid, depending on what continuity we're in. John Constantine might put a demon in me, you know, like who knows. So and then this isn't in the U.S., but one place I would absolutely want to see if I were visiting the DC Universe is Nanda Parbat, where Dead Man, you know, and Ramakrishna, I can't remember the name of the – is it Ramakrishna? Yeah, Ramakrishna or Ramakrishna, his sort of deity – that's such a good question, man. That is, and I'd wanted to see the JLA satellite.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a hell of a climb up there.
To yeah, there, yeah.
When you said Crime Alley, the first thing that popped in my mind was there's some Gotham street vendor there with roses that they're selling people.
Oh my god,
that they can throw them down.
Yeah, they'd be fake pearls, you know,
because it's a good way to make money if it's a tourist spot.
Yeah. Joe Chill's is an ice cream shop. I mean, yeah, I mean it's got to be. It would just be amazing, you know. They have a little Zorro, you know. They're showing Zorro 24 hours a day, and that's such a good question, man. That was really, really good. That's so funny. So before we cut away from the issue for good, was there a favorite panel or page in the art that you loved? And this one's a little tricky because there's not a lot of action in this book. And actually, oddly for Perez, there are no splash pages. So this is a more challenging one. But did you have a favorite piece of art?
I do, actually. Mine is on page 18. It's actually two overlapping panels, but it's kind of in one panel. But it's the one of Diana flying in her robe away from the ruins. And it's just the look in Stavros's eyes as he's looking up at her saying, "My God, I forgot she can fly. How incredibly beautiful." And the look on Julia's face also, she's like, "Yep, that's our Diana." And you know, she has just this look of love in her eyes, just watching, you know, this goddess here on earth, smiling and being happy, flying, soaring with the birds to their next spot. You know, I thought that panel or panels were really, really well done.
Yeah. Perez's acting, especially with Giordano on inks, is so good. And you can see like the multitude of emotions on Stavros's face, which is like, one, that's the most incredibly beautiful woman I've ever seen. But two, there's awe there. It's not like a sexual thing. It's more of like I'm in the presence of true, you know, godhood, of true beauty. And then Julia really understanding it, being like, yeah, I've been drunk on that view before too, you know?
And it never gets old. Yeah.
No, that's a great choice. So I went with page 14, the bottom panels. So this is where there's the man who's trying to reach Diana at the airport to tell her something. We will, you know, we know later that it's going to be about Cersei, but before he can get to her, all these animals with these red eyes come and attack him and tear him to pieces. But George does a really cool, very 80s, I feel like it's like a Miami Vice episode thing, where he juxtaposes the loud fanfare of a band playing the Greek national anthem for Diana at the airport with the silent chase through the dark of this man by these animals to kill him. So it's a really cool, I don't know, there's just, I can hear saxophone in the background. I think it's a really cool little vignette.
Yeah, he's telling two stories at the same time. One is the panel in the background, the dude running for his life.
Yeah.
The other is these different kids playing their instruments and playing it so loud it seems like it cuts off his screams so nobody can hear it.
Yeah, it's a very television kind of moment, so it's really cool. Then I would just give a quick honorable mention, though I wish this had been a splash page. I wish this had been more grandiose, of the look at Olympus and, you know, an Olympus ravaged by Darkseid and Desaad from Action 600, including Darkseid's favorite trick of carving his own face into stone. I mean, you know, see Daxem from the Legion of Superheroes, you know, and the gods like really looking around their home and seeing it just utterly destroyed. So again, I wish I'd gotten a splash page of it because I think it would have been more grandiose, but, you know, definitely worth a shout out.
Oh, yeah. And Heracles looking at that picture of that stone face of Darkseid, you can tell, you know, him just getting pissed. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not happy. And it's also a cool little shout out from George to Keith Giffen, you know, from the Great Darkness saga with the Legion. So kind of a nice little touch there. And so that brings us to the end of the issue, but not quite the end of the episode, because every episode of Peace Bound and Down ends with a segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, where we take up Diana's charge to bring a little peace to the world. And it can be silly or serious or fun, whatever we decide it to be. And since you're the guest, Keith, why don't you go first? How would you bring some peace to man's world?
The first thing that popped to my mind is, and I can't remember if anyone's ever has already said this on your show. So if they have, I have a backup one. But yeah, it's mine is that there would be mandatory earbuds in public spaces.
Oh, like, this is good. No, keep going.
like waiting areas, getting your oil changed, or airplanes. In fact, United Airlines is actually starting to do this. They're going to require people to have earbuds with their phones.
That's good.
If they're going to be playing them. But hallways, elevators, you know, people are FaceTiming in a waiting room. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to hear both sides of your conversations. Or I don't want to hear the 27 TikToks that you play in a row on the same subject while I'm waiting to get my oil changed. But yeah, if it could be required where, if you're out in public, if you're off of your personal Wi-Fi at your house, your phone automatically requires earbuds for you to hear the audio. I think that would decrease stress across the board and create peace. At least it would create peace in my world. But
I think that's brilliant. I love it. You and I are of similar ages. I don't know if I'm just getting to be a curmudgeon in my old age, but I am so shell-shocked when I'm like standing in line, you know, at like a deli or a bakery or something. Like I'll swing by, I'll be taking my daughter to school in the morning and I'll swing by this little shop to get a bagel for her and for me. And I'll be standing in line and it's packed. Like there are a ton of people there and there'll always be somebody talking into their phone like a walkie-talkie. Yep. And you can hear the whole side conversation. And the other day I looked at somebody doing that and I said, hey, you know what's really cool about that thing in your hand? It works as a phone where you can put it up to your ear so not everybody has to hear your entire conversation. And the girl looked at me like death glare, but the people around me all went, thank you. And like, so she kind of got the point. But I was so the asshole old man. I was the total Marin in the line. I was totally the old curmudgeon. But I'm really glad you said that because it is super annoying. Yeah, I don't like it at all. So I have mine is silly and not as smart as yours. But again, I have to come up with one of these every episode. And some are going to be bangers and some aren't. This one is definitely in the not phase, but it was something I thought about. So very recently, I was in a pretty high stakes work meeting down at our state capitol with like some pretty important people, you know, who make some big decisions for my state. And during that meeting, somebody was tooting silently and it was, you know, not great to be in that room. And it was horrible because as a guy, but especially as like I'm a big fat Mexican, big fat hairy Mexican dude. I feel like I look like the guy who did the thing, even though I didn't do the thing. And so I'm always assuming that all eyes are on me and are casting aspersions around me. And I always feel like extra guilty. But it was like happening. It was like a 90-minute meeting. It was happening the whole meeting. And, you know, all of us were aware it was happening. No one was saying anything. But it was really, really annoying. And so I would love to have, because I felt, even though if no one probably was, I felt unfairly judged. I felt like people thought it was me. And so I feel like there should be an aerosol that comes out of the ceiling, like in public bathrooms where it just sprays after any time a toilet is flushed. But if there are more than like, say, three people in a room, an aerosol, you know, sprays out of the room with the AC and it colors the source of the, you know, offending toot and it turns it into rainbow to give it a little bit of whimsy. I'm not trying to be a jerk, you know, bodily functions are bodily functions. People have them. And, you know, especially as people get older, they can't always control things. So, you know, we'll have it be a fun thing with like glitter and rainbow and, you know, and maybe musical notes or something. But I really feel like we need to have a system by which people are no longer facing the burden of being falsely accused of tooting in a small room. So that's my big piece to man's world.
That's awesome, man. And it, actually that reminds me. So sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll say something to my wife and forget about it. But it's one of those things where I think I have something brilliant and I say it to her so that somebody will remember it in the morning. And so anyway, remember, we're an old married couple. Middle of the night, I wake up and, you know, I toot. And, and she makes the sound. She's like, oh, my God. So I say to her, I said, butt plugs by Glade. And when I woke up in the morning, she goes, what were you talking about? You said something about butt plugs by Glade. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, Glade, it's a $1 million product. That's the idea I had. You know, Glade can make butt plugs with different smell flavors. You know, I don't know what aisle they would sell it on at the food line, but, you know. she goes, that is a horrible idea. I was like, well, maybe underwear by Glade.
There you go. It's a great idea.
Yeah, something to filter it through, and all of a sudden, you know, the meeting room smells like ocean breeze.
There you go. There you go. And then that way no one's upset. It's, you know, and like, you know, the smell floats by you, but like you said, it's ocean breeze or cool rush, you know, or like, field field of flowers or whatever. I think you have a $1 million idea, man. I think that is brilliant. And I think that is a way to go. That is awesome. So Keith, that does bring us to the end of this part of the episode. I'm so very thrilled to have gotten to record with you. I have to tell you, you know, again, you know, we have kind of circled each other, you know, we've known each other online for years and, you know, and listened to a lot of the same shows and have commented on a lot of the same shows. But this has been such a blast to get to actually talk to each other. And you know, and I so appreciate you being on this episode to talk about this issue. So why don't you tell the folks where they can find you?
Well, I'm glad you had me on here. I've been listening since the beginning, and you do such a great job on the show.
Thank you.
And it's wonderful to be here. Finding me, I don't really do a lot, but I've been working on a project for decades now. And in fact, Frank will probably say something somewhere about it. way overboard. But I keep a list of professional sports in the DC Comics universe. And in my mind, if they existed in, like, say, the AFC of the NFL or something like that, like where they would fall. And
that's awesome.
So anyway, it's called Sports and Comics. It's a Wix website right now. It's just bare bones. It's a kgbunc.wixsite.com/sportsandcomics. Or if anybody wants to send me an email at sportsandcomics@gmail.com. I don't read a lot of modern comics, but if anybody ever sees a panel where it's mentioning like the Metropolis Meteors or something like that, just send me the issue number and I'll track it down. Like, eventually, I want to make that website into a database for writers and artists maybe to use, because sometimes they get them wrong. And it,
oh yeah,
for a sports fan like me, it bothers me when they say stuff like Clark Kent's favorite team is the Metropolis Meteors, when we know it's the Monarchs. That, you know, it's but yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm the Steve Lombard of the comic world.
That is amazing. So it's funny that you mentioned the Metropolis Monarchs, because right when you were talking, I was like, oh, there was a recent issue of, there's a Batman Superman World's Finest book that's out. Mark Waid writes it. Dan Mora did the art for a long time. Recently, they've had other artists, all of whom have been great. But if you're an old head like us and you love Bronze Age comics, this is Mark Waid's love letter to Bronze Age Superman and Batman comics. And it's set in it's still set in like DC continuity, but it's more of like a, hey, if you're reading this, you're agreeing not to get super hung up on things. Like, just have fun. Like, just come in and read a really fun story about Superman, Batman, and Robin, and maybe the Doom Patrol will show up, and, you know, Aquaman will show up. And so recently there was an issue where Clark and Bruce are hanging out together as Clark and Bruce at Bruce's house, and they are watching a Gotham Knights versus Metropolis. I can't remember if they say Monarchs or Meteors game, and Clark is chastising Bruce because he said the team has sucked ever since Bruce bought them. So Bruce is now canonically the owner of the Gotham Knights, which is too funny. Like, I love the idea of Bruce as a football team owner, and like there being like segments on First Take on ESPN about how crappy Bruce Wayne is running the team and how, you know, he let their star quarterback get away or something. I just think it's hilarious. So that's really cool, man.
Oh yeah, I could see Steve Lombard on. Yeah. Pardon the interruption. You know,
oh yeah,
coming on there and yelling about this Bruce Wayne fella. He has more money than sense, you know, letting this player go or something like that. Yeah.
That's so awesome, man. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much again for joining me. Truly, this has been so much fun. And I loved getting to talk about this issue. I love getting to start this era of George being the sort of lone voice for a little bit. He's going to give up the art duties in a little while, but it's a lot of fun to get to see his full vision on this book. Listeners, hang tight. We will play a podcast promo break and then be back with your feedback from Action Comics 600, with an episode that I co-hosted with Michael Bailey. So hang tight, we'll be back in a sec.
I believe there's a hero in all of us that keeps us honest, gives us strength, makes us noble.
And his name is
a damn fine cup of coffee.
Do you enjoy comic books? Do you perhaps enjoy reading said comics while also consuming a tasty beverage? Well, hello, my friend. I am the caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and I invite you to join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, where I look at a random comic roughly in the span of time it takes to have a nice little coffee break. So if you enjoy casual comics discussion and references potentially even more dated and randomly strung together than the ones in this promo, be sure to check out the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on all the most brewtastic podcast apps.
Drink, I like it.
I know, it's great, right?
Another!
Hey, where are all my comic books?
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback from Action Comics 600, which I covered with Michael Bailey.
As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com, as it helps folks to find the show. We kick the feedback off with network co-founder and host of MASHcast and Fade Out and other great shows, Rob Kelly, who writes, I enjoyed this little break from the Wonder Woman book. I never liked the Superman-Wonder Woman as a couple idea. It lessens and weakens both characters. Paris and Byrne dealt with and dismissed them so quickly, so of course DC tried it again with New 52. Sigh. Adding to the discussion that Michael and I had about working third shift, Rob adds, I worked at a Kinko's during the overnight 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. Ouch. The parade of freaks that staggered in was so painful, we had a standard operating procedure for when someone tried to use the self-service copy machine to copy their bare ass. Yes, it happened that many times that the company had a dedicated procedure for it. I hated the job so much, it was the only time I quit a job without having another lined up. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I'm telling you, Rob, I really am thinking of doing a Legends of the Third Shift miniseries show on Fire and Water. The bare-ass SOP alone has got me convinced. Bucky749 continues the commentary on the idea of pairing up Superman and Wonder Woman, saying, I think the debate is as old as time, but honestly, since the Justice League Unlimited episode where the heroes are turned into kids, I've always thought Bruce and Diana were a better match. I just think she's a better match for Bruce in my mind. It's like putting Archie and Josie together to put Superman and Wonder Woman as a pair. It's too obvious. Yeah, I totally agree. I agree, Bucky. I like Bruce and Diana as a pair much better than Clark and Diana. David Ace Gutierrez is up next, agreeing with Bucky and I, saying, Bruce and Diana are a much better match. Agreed. Everyone thinks it's Selina or Talia, but I'm going with Diana. But I'm Team Lana for Clark. But then again, I think Archie belongs with Betty, so it may just be more of that. Dad comments on my question to Michael about his favorite Lois Lane, saying, great as Lois? I say it's Erica Durance. Great choice, and like you, Dad, I also agree that Archie belongs with Betty. Podcaster extraordinaire and host of Outcasters Under Siege, which covers the Avengers Under Siege arc, Tim Price writes in next, saying, so Byrne liked establishing that his Superman had super versions of all human senses, including super smell, but I guess he doesn't have super empathy or super reading the room from Diana's wide-eyed shock over multiple panels. Hoo boy. Oh my god, Tim, that totally made me laugh. Yeah, Clark does not read the moment at the beginning of Action Comics 600, and Byrne and Perez just make the reader sit in it, which is awesome storytelling. Tim goes on to say, I really appreciated the touch of parademons changing the sculpture of Zeus's face to dark sides. It evoked imagery from the Legion's Great Darkness saga, carving his face into the entire planet of Daxam. And that's how Big Darkseid's ego is. Plus, if there's any question that Big Darkseid is a fascist, it answers itself. Yeah, no kidding. And I thought the exact same thing. I was like, man, this reminds me of something. And I was like, oh yeah, Legion, the impossible recarving of Daxam, which is, I mean, just one of the great arcs of all time. Super Captain is up next, writing, I agree 100% that the 90s Juergens, Stern, Ordway, Simonson era is my era of Superman, even though I didn't read it as it was being published. Oh, that's really interesting, Super Captain. Michael and I talked about how Byrne gets justifiably a lot of the credit, most of the credit, for the revamp of Superman in the 80s. But for a lot of us, it's the teams that followed Byrne that really, really imprinted Superman on us as fans forever. Responding to the secret question about favorite awkward romantic moments, Super Captain writes, as for awkward romantic moments, the late lamented Freaks and Geeks had several. I would have to go with Nick, Jason Siegel, singing the Styx song Lady to an obviously unnerved Linda Cardinelli, and an honorable mention goes to Nick singing his own composition all about Lindsay called Lady L, while his friends look on in horror. That is a great pull, Super Captain. I love the fact that the movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which Jason Siegel wrote and stars in, is literally about his breakup with Linda Cardinelli. And every time I watch that movie and I think about that, I find it even funnier. Super Captain comments on our discussion about working third shift, saying, finally, when I was a seminary student, many of us were required to serve for a summer or a semester or even a year as a hospital chaplain. Overnight in the emergency room, you might not meet a madam or have someone drop the trousers right in front of you. But then again, you just might. Great show, Sean and Michael. That is so funny, Super Captain. I can't imagine the things you saw in the overnight shift at the ER. Yeah, the legends of the third shift, the momentum is growing and growing and growing. Network all-star and host of DC Supercast, Paul Kien, writes in next saying, great episode as always. The kiss scene at the beginning was executed so well. It is so memorable for Diana's eyes. Today, Superman would have been to enough JLA HR training to know not to lead with the kiss, but back then, easily the most memorable aspect of this anniversary issue. And I agree with the cover and splash should have been switched. Best Lois
agree Bitsy was awesome. He agrees with Michael's choice. But I actually loved Rachel Bresnahan's portrayal in the recent movie. I loved her composing the story while piloting Mr. Terrific's ship. Always a pleasure to hear Michael Bailey back on the network. Yeah, Paul, I agree with you, actually. I thought Rachel Bresnahan was an amazing Lois, and I hope gets to portray Lois in many, many movies to come. Brett Young, host of the Fantastic Four and founder of the Philadelphia branch of the Dallas Cowboys fan club, writes in to say, great show, Sean and Michael. This episode certainly had roughly 30% more penis talk than usual. Tales from the Third Shift would certainly be a podcast to which I'd subscribe. I remember being so excited for this issue when it came out. My two favorite artists teaming up for a story featuring a Superman-Wonder Woman date. And then it boils down to Superman having no game and Darkseid getting hosed on a real estate deal. I hate how accurate that is, Brett, but that's 100% true. Brett goes on to say, the art is terrific, however, especially the four-panel fight pages. The one nitpick I have is the way Byrne drew Darkseid with serious dad bod, not too intimidating. Regarding fave Lois Lane, I'm actually promoting the newcomer to the top of the list, just like Paul Kinn. Rachel Bresnahan was terrific in the latest Superman movie. I'd add Erica Durance and Dana Delaney to round out the top three. Commenting on another secret question about favorite X in any medium, Brett says, finally, favorite X by far is Madeline Pryor. Still think Scott should be with her. Pacey did have great chemistry with Joey. By the way, every time I think of Joshua Jackson, I think of the Skulls. I still love that dumb movie. That's so funny. I take every opportunity I can to slip in that in Dawson's Creek, Joey and Pacey were a much better pair than Dawson and Joey. Nate the Great is next saying, yeah, Superman and Wonder Woman should have been at least a quick romance, though Diana might have more in common with Batman or Aquaman. Still, the issue was memorable for the Byrne Perez team up on art. Favorite Lois, Terry Hatcher, followed by Erica Durance. Great choices, Nate, and I mean, there are no wrong choices. And bringing us to a close is an incredibly thorough and thoughtful comment from Isamu Hideki Yukinori about the art on the issue. Isamu writes, this was a great show and fun discussion, Uncle Sean and Uncle Michael. I recently did some digging into how the art chores for this issue was shared between Messrs. Byrne and Perez for a few somewhat lengthy social media discussions, and I thought I would share a few highlights with you here. Uncle Sean, you mentioned that Diana has a very Perezian face and Perez eyes throughout the story. There's a reason for that. Mr. Byrne had drawn very rough pencil layouts. He was working on several books a month at the time, with very light details for the background, but virtually no details for Wonder Woman herself. The two had already agreed beforehand that almost all of the Wonder Woman figures in the story would be completely drawn, penciled, and inked by Mr. Perez. There were a few exceptions for this agreement that you may and may not have noticed. According to the George Perez interview published in the fanzine Interlac, issue 73, Mr. Byrne fully penciled and inked the figures of Wonder Woman that was Amazing Grace in disguise, while Perez fully penciled and inked the figures of Superman, who was a disguised Kalibak. That was to give readers a slight visual cue that something was off in those scenes. That is such an amazing fact, Isamu. That's so incredible that I had to go back to Action Comics 600 and look and zero in on those panels. And you're right, you can see it. It's just enough to show you that something is off. It's great, great find in your research. Isamu further comments, Wonder Woman and the fake Superman were not the only characters fully rendered by Mr. Perez in the story. He also penciled and inked the depictions of the Greek gods in panels 1 and 2 of page 17. A Xeroxed copy of John Byrne's breakdowns on that page show a completely blank first panel with a penciled note, the Greek gods, ... all yours, George. And the hologram in panel 2 had a slight semblance of standing figures with a note, more GG for GP. Again, Isamu, what a great find. That is so awesome. I love this back and forth between George and John. I mean, talk about two legends. It's like Paul and John writing Let It Be and going back and forth on the piano chords. I mean, just brilliant. Isamu goes on to comment on Byrne's tendency to use the new gods to explain the power of the Greek gods, writing, I found it interesting that Mr. Byrne wanted to establish an origin for the Greek gods that connected to Jack Kirby's new gods in the story, which I understand Mr. Perez did not agree with, and thus dismissed the idea as a misunderstanding by Darkseid in an upcoming Cersei story, which you will cover soon. Only for Mr. Byrne, when he took over the Wonder Woman title in issue 101, to reestablish that connection again in his first storyline. That is such a great observation. Byrne definitely goes right back to that well in issues, that first opening arc of his Wonder Woman run, starting with 101. He does it again in the Genesis miniseries, in his Jack Kirby's New God series. Definitely, it's a story, that Genesis wave idea, something Byrne really liked, even though I don't think the audience ever attached to it. I certainly did not. Isamu, and I can't encourage people enough to go and read the comments on the webpage, because Isamu further talks about a one-shot Perez was going to do in between Action Comics 600 and the Wonder Woman and Superman issues that preceded it, basically setting up this rendezvous, telling the story of this interaction, but in a very, very different way. In fact, in the interview that Isamu quotes, Perez says that he was going to have Wonder Woman and Superman actually connect physically, that they were going to be involved romantically, and you know, he was going to treat it as almost a, you know, an Elseworlds, maybe not, you could sort of decide for yourself, but really examine the repercussions of the two of them getting together. So very interesting. Arigato gozaimasu, Isamu. That was an amazing bit of research on your part. I super appreciate you sharing it. Just fascinating facts from Perez and Byrne on how they went back and forth between the art. And thank you to everybody who listened to the episode. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. Thank you to Keith G. Baker, my guest on this episode. Thank you to Michael Bailey, my guest on Action 600. And thanks to everybody for helping me bring a little bit of peace to man's world.